Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Recently, I began watching a four-part documentary series on Angel Studios called Live Not by Lies, which is based on the 2020 book by Rod Dreher. I've only just started, so I can't say much about the series yet, except that it's good so far. I definitely recommend it because it compellingly presents an important message. I loved the book, and I've actually given it to some friends. The subtitle of the book is A Manual for Christian Dissidents, and the book uses the testaments of survivors of Soviet totalitarianism who managed to preserve their faith and their integrity through times of tyranny, as a warning to us today in the West that totalitarianism is on the rise again, what the author calls a soft totalitarianism that creeps up on us in ways that are difficult to see as a threat until it's too late. Americans have been blessed with unprecedented freedom for the 250 years of our history, so blessed that it's impossible for most of us to imagine that we could ever succumb to totalitarian tyranny. We tell ourselves, it could never happen here. Famous last words, right? Look at how successfully the left has captured every institution of the culture, from universities to the entertainment arena to the news media. Look at how successful they have been at flooding the nation with a small nation's worth of illegal immigrants to change our demography and our electoral politics. Look at how successful they were, until recently, at weaponizing nearly every government agency from the IRS to the FBI against patriotic citizens. Look at how successful they have been at dumbing down generation after generation of young people who now don't know their own history, are disconnected from their own civilizational legacy, who don't understand the way their own political system operates, who have been indoctrinated to reject capitalism for socialism, to reject Christianity for a sort of religion of self and identity, to reject freedom of speech as a tool for fascism, to reject rational debate for the assassination of political opponents. Look at how successful the radical left has been at steering this country toward embracing one-party hegemony and totalitarian thinking. Not only can it happen here, but it inevitably will happen here unless American patriots recognize the warning signs, sound the alarm, and unite to protect our freedoms, rights, and prosperity. One of those American patriots who is sounding the alarm is my guest today at The Right Take, and we're going to talk about just how much of a foothold totalitarianism has in this country and what to do about it. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, a senior visiting fellow at Hillsdale College, and professor emeritus at Assumption University. He's written widely on everything from French politics to the Russian dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn to totalitarianism. He's the author of several books, among them The Idol of Our Age, How the Religion of Humanity Subverts Christianity, which I'm looking forward to reading next, and a new one I finished recently called The Persistence of the Ideological Lie, The Totalitarian Impulse Then and Now. Daniel J. Mahoney, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Mark.
I've been looking forward to this because there's so many big ideas to explore in your writing, I hardly know where to begin. How about if we start with this recent three-part series of articles you did at The American Mind titled Christianity in the West? That's the kind of big picture topic I'd love to dive into. In that series, you argue that Christianity in the West stand or fall with the recovery of right reason and the moral law as understood by the great tradition. Could you explain that, please? And what inspired you to address that topic so urgently?
Well, I've been addressing it for a while, and it is a subject I take up in The Idol of Our Age, which is a book about the increasing conflation and confusion of Christianity with soft compassion, a kind of humanitarian relativism, a preoccupation with the transformation of social structures rather than the deeper and abiding message of biblical religion. I think, a lot of churchmen, progressives in particular, but not just progressives, increasingly don't know that Christianity is not the religion of humanity. It is not a religion that posits mercy divorced from repentance and justice. It is a very demanding religion that demands a turning around of the soul. It respects and needs to respect authority and authoritative institutions. It's not coextensive with pacifism or, the care for the poor has nothing to do, as I'm afraid some recent popes have mistakenly asserted, with egalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
Inequality in itself. I'm not talking about moral or civic inequality. I'm talking about, a certain kind of social inequality is perfectly in accord with the recognition of our fundamental duties to our neighbor. So this three-part series was initially occasioned by the death of Pope Francis, who I think embodied the tendency or temptation within progressivist Christian circles to, and I quote here the French Thomist philosopher Jacques Maritain, who in the midst of the Second Vatican Council wrote an autobiography called Le Paysan de la Garonne, The Peasant of the Garonne, an area, a province in France he was from. And he said, look, I had always encouraged a self-respecting dialogue between the church and the modern world. But he said, not a capitulation. And he had a wonderful phrase in that book. He introduced a phrase called kneeling before the world, kind of genuflection before the zeitgeist. I think that was, more often, whether it was climate change or attitudes toward Islam, in the Joy of the Gospel, a 2014 apostolic letter from Pope Francis, he said, the Quran is incompatible with every kind of violence. It's just not true. St. Augustine says the church can err badly from lack of empirical information. Well, boy, Pope Leo, who I think is not Pope Francis, but seems to be a bit naive when it comes to some political matters, although I think he's much more Christ-centered than his predecessor. But he recently upheld Lebanon as a model of interreligious cooperation.
Yes.
The Christians have been driven out, the Maronites and others of Lebanon. The demographic transformations in the country have been quite dramatic. And the entire country has been held hostage by Hezbollah. So it takes a certain blindness, I think, not to confront those fundamental realities. And of course, in my three-part series, I look back at Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II. They made their mistakes. I think we wouldn't have gotten Pope Francis if Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II had not appointed so many cardinals who turned out to be less orthodox, less sensible than they expected them to be. Francis didn't appoint anyone who wasn't in his progressivist group. But anyway, my series looks at the prospects for a recovery of a broader and deeper Catholic and Christian wisdom. I think we'll get some of that with Leo, but we'll probably get more of the same when it comes to, a little bit of the Vatican acting like the left-wing party at prayer. So I wanted to dig deeper. I didn't want to just deal with current events, but I wanted, I'm trying to introduce a broader readership to this conflation of Christianity with mercy without repentance, of social justice confused with socialism, of ecumenism that is blind to the fundamental nature of Islam. I'm not talking about unremitting hostility to Islam, but realism about Islam and its different currents. And certainly to say that Islam is incompatible with every resort to violence is silly. I mean, jihad is central, and the war against the infidel is central to authentic Islam. And Muhammad's message, of course, was not to point the sword inward like Jesus. Jesus was not, there's a reason why the Muslim world conquered all of North Africa the historically Christian Middle East and Spain and made it within an hour of Paris in 732.
Yes.
And it wasn't an accident. It wasn't a historically contingent phenomenon, if I can put it that way.
Right. You do write in the series that the church continues to present herself too much of the time as a left-of-center humanitarian NGO, which is increasingly revealing an intellectual and moral bankruptcy. Am I a bad Christian, Dan, for wishing that the church and the Pope in these times would embrace a more, let's say, militant and culturally self-confident posture in order to counter not only a hostile secular culture, but the threat posed by militant Islam?
No, I mean, we don't. It's not, you know, the West is in crisis. The church is in crisis. Militant Islam is a very real phenomenon in the world. It doesn't mean that one mustn't dialogue with moderate Muslims who oppose extremism. But I love to quote the French political thinker Jean-François Revel, who I once heard say, the problem with moderate Muslims is they're far too moderate with their moderation. No, it's not a time for papalatry, this illusion, the silliness that every utterance from a pope as infallible writ. You know, if that were the case, everything that anti-Catholics said about the Catholic Church would be true, that one pope could negate the historic teaching of the church. Or, you know, the church had a long-standing and admirable opposition to communist and Nazi totalitarianism. But if a pope comes along who shows a kind of indulgence toward, a weakness toward progressivist tyranny, we're not obliged as faithful Christians, in this case faithful Catholics, to follow this ill-advised path. So the Catholic Church is not about papal voluntarism. Whatever the latest pope has said is authoritative in every regard. You know, Francis had a tendency to emphasize things that were, you know, simply a matter of empirical and prudential judgment and make them authoritative for Christians, like a certain interpretation of climate change or economic redistribution or third worldism, while downplaying the non-negotiable orthodoxies at the center of the faith. So, no. And I'm a strong believer that the Christian religion stands or falls with Western civilization. So
yeah.
We can't be blind to the fate of the West. And frankly, I'm rather startled that this Pope too seems to think Europe should just have open borders and allow, you know, in the name of humanitarianism, allow itself to be demographically, culturally, spiritually, and politically transformed. This kind of blindness to fundamental realities is a result, I think, of the conflation of Christianity and soft humanitarianism. You know, a French friend of mine, a very distinguished scholar, Alain Besançon, liked to say, Jesus calls on us to love our enemies, which presupposes we have enemies. And C.S. Lewis, in his essay, Why I'm Not a Pacifist, even went so far as to say, sometimes we've got to shoot our enemies while loving them. So those are the kinds of remarks that, by the way, not shoot them in a back alley or in a bar, but in a just war.
Yes.
Yeah. And the church has forgotten, I think, as the great Orthodox theologian Vladimir Soloviev said at the beginning of the 20th century, there can be such a thing as an evil peace.
Yes.
Peace of the graveyard, the peace of despotism. That doesn't mean we should be waging perpetual war, you know, at the service of, you know, utopian projects to democratize the world or spread the blessings of the LGBTQ+++ agenda to Arabia or to Eastern Europe. But it does mean we need to show realism about original sin, realism about the world we live in. We need to see that negotiation is not always the best solution. I think Trump has been right to pursue negotiations in a series of cases where they can lead to fruitful outcomes. But the idea that war is always a defeat, as the last few popes have said, and negotiated settlements are always possible, shows a remarkable naivete about both politics and human nature.
Dan, I know that you're very familiar with Rod Dreher's book, Live Not by Lies. Should we be taking his warning to heart that Christians need to be prepared for the soft totalitarianism that we're kind of currently experiencing to intensify? As many people have pointed out in recent years, Christianity in the West is in decline, maybe even falling off a cliff. How do you see the battle royale of Christianity and politics and the culture playing out over the next, say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, you know, it's hard to you know, history is so contingent. There are things that are happening now, like the rise of anti-Semitism with the young on the pseudo-right that I hardly could have imagined even a couple of years ago. So, but look, I think there are powerful forces in the culture and in our politics that are deeply and profoundly anti-Christian. They're not only anti-Christian, they're anti-Jewish, they're anti-West, they're committed to the subversion of the moral foundations of Western and democratic civilization. We're obliged to resist them. I think what I do in my book, The Persistence of the Ideological Lie, The Totalitarian Impulse Then and Now, is I certainly recommend Rod's book in my book. I build on his warning about the ideological mendacity that is threatening us at home and abroad.
Yeah.
But I also, I think, try to deepen our understanding of what the ideological lie is. And I relate it to what I call Manichaeanism. You know, instead of seeing, following Solzhenitsyn and others in this regard, the lie is first and foremost a denial of the drama of good and evil in each and every human soul and heart.
Yeah.
The ideological lie localizes evil. It's not intrinsic to fallen and imperfect man, something the biblical idiom is fallen human nature. Aristotle talks about, you know, a certain wickedness inherent in man that, you know, can only be overcome through self-control. I mean, I think the Christians are superior to the classics, and they realize we need God's grace for this and not just self-limitation. But self-limitation and self-knowledge are a very, very good start. So, but when you localize evil in Hitler with the Jews or the communists with the bourgeoisie and the Christians and the exploiter class, if you think that total revolution and the total critique of society will culminate in a new man and a new society rather than giving unprecedented power to those who lack the self-knowledge to recognize their own imperfection and incompleteness. And woke ideology, as I point out in the book, with its preoccupation with race, you know, with the evils of white men, with all of this, is just another version of this ideological Manichaeanism, this ideological mendacity that goes back really to the French Revolution. You know, one of the partisans of the French Revolution, the Count of Chambord, once said, be my brother or I will kill you.
Yes.
You know, so much violence, so much oppression, so much persecution was committed by those who were trying to forcibly impose fraternity. One of the glories of America is when we fought a revolution to guarantee our national independence and to establish the blessings of liberty under the Federal Constitution of 1787, we did not try to forcibly impose fraternity, community. By the way, fraternity is a very good thing, but Americans did not run around calling each other citoyens, citizens, or comrades. Politically enforced brotherhood, politically enforced egalitarianism is a nightmare. It is something which guarantees terror and totalitarianism and a kind of permanent social engineering of the human soul. So looking into the future, I think conservative-minded people or anti-woke people have always made the mistake of thinking that the latest electoral cycle will solve our problem. And by the way, not having a national administration committed to wokeness, to tyrannical transgenderism, to a sort of vaguely socialist ideology, to blindness about our friends and enemies in the world, that's a great start. Not having the bureaucratic apparatus at a state supporting the cancellation of independent-minded people, not encouraging social media companies to repress, you know, half the country that doesn't agree with the revolution that was unfolding just a few years ago. That's a good step. But center-right parties have won elections in the United States and elsewhere for many years, going back to Reagan and Thatcher. And yet, the cultural revolution proceeded apace. Andrew Sullivan, whose political and moral authority I don't normally cite, but who has some lucidity about wokeness, said in 2020, you know, all these parents who thought you could send your kids to Williams or, you know, some equivalent, some Ivy League school, and they would come out, well, they'd go out in the real world eventually and sort of forget all the indoctrination they learned. He said it was nonsense because he says we're all living on college campus now.
Yes.
And by the way, I would add one more feature of the – and by the way, those traits, those tendencies are still deeply ensconced in the institutions of civil society. It's nice, for example, to have an administration that is – trying to de-ideologize the armed forces. That's a good step. But we should not fool ourselves that that the problem of institutionalized wokeness, mendacity, these very strong instantiations of the ideological lie are all around us. And, you know, it doesn't just start in college. Much of this indoctrination around what the late, great Sir Roger Scruton, the conservative political philosopher, British English political philosopher, called the culture of repudiation.
Yes.
Deep-seated project to repudiate our civilization, to teach young people that is the source of racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, a concerted effort to undermine classical thought, biblical religion, the dignity of the American founding. We'd be foolish to think most of that has gone away.
You anticipated so many of my questions just then, but let me interject here with something that seems like a basic question, but which might be really helpful for a lot of listeners to understand exactly what the word entails. What is totalitarianism, and how's it different from authoritarianism or fascism or any other similar ism?
All right. I'll help the listener out with a few essential distinctions. Let's start with, since we live in an era where we regularly confront what the political philosopher Leo Strauss 75 years ago called the reductio ad Hitlerum, you know, where you support traditional institutions. You know, we're on the road to Hitlerite despotism and all that. Fascism is not National Socialism. Yeah. Mussolini was not an anti-Semite. Jews belonged to the Fascist Party. Even though Mussolini was the first 20th century leader, European leader, in a speech in 1926 and another one in 29, to talk about the need for a totalitarian state. In fact, Italian fascism was quite modest. They didn't have death camps. You know, the secret police might pour castor oil down the throats of political dissidents, but it was not a particularly murderous regime until it came under the yoke of Hitler's Germany during World War II. And it was counterbalanced by the church and by the Italian monarchy under Victor Emmanuel. Nazism is a horse of a different color. It's an essentially genocidal and racist ideology. Hitler's project was deeply anti-Christian, deeply nihilistic, deeply committed to the extirpation of traditional wisdom and traditional institutions. We have to take seriously the socialist part of National Socialism. But even Nazism only became fully totalitarian with the outbreak of the war. And then there was the beginning of an effort to undermine all the institutions of civil society, particularly the churches, and of course to carry out the monstrous effort of the Final Solution to create a Judenrein or Judenfrei Europe that led to the extermination of 5.9 to 6.1 million European Jews. Communism is a paradoxical ideology because on the one hand, Marx and Lenin proclaim that at the end of history, eventually the state will wither away. And as Marx famously said, man will be free to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, write criticism in the evening without becoming a hunter, a fisher, or a critic. But in the meantime, you needed a dictatorship of the proletarian, you needed draconian repression of the enemies of the people, you needed a hyper-centralized state, you needed collective ownership of property. Marx defines communism in the second part of the Communist Manifesto as by four abolitions: the abolition of private property, the abolition of the family, the abolition of religion, and the abolition of the nation. And I would suggest that any political or ideological project that aims at those abolitions is necessarily, inherently, inescapably totalitarian. Authoritarian states are those where the state may have, or a reigning political group may have, a monopoly or a quasi-monopoly on power. You know, contemporary Russia, there are opposition parties, but they never win the elections. But they're not totalitarian states in that the churches are generally left alone. People can publish books on different subjects. There's not full-scale indoctrination. There's usually not mass violence. You know, it's much better to live in Franco or Salazar's Spain and Portugal than in a communist totalitarian state after 1945. There was a much more rapid and immediate transition to a free political system, let's say in Spain after Franco died, because the foundations of civil society had not been destroyed by the authoritarian regime. One more final qualification. No totalitarian regime is fully totalitarian. Totalitarianism, the ambition to engineer human souls, to transform human nature, to create a new Soviet man. These are ambitions that are inherently totalitarian, but of course cannot be carried out completely. But I would argue that the aspiration for totalitarian control does an awful lot of damage, massive damage to society and human nature.
Yes.
It doesn't succeed in the long run, but it can. Totalitarianism, totalitarian regimes and ideologies may not be able in the end to transform human nature, to conquer human nature. But they can do a great deal to undermine it, to mutilate it, to oppress it. Notice the subtitle of my book, The Totalitarian Impulse Then and Now. I'm not suggesting we live in a totalitarian country.
Mm-hmm.
I am suggesting the totalitarian impulse is very present in contemporary life, in civil society, in institutions like the university or journalism or Hollywood or some of our political parties. And so we have to beware that the totalitarian impulse does not culminate in totalitarian politics.
You have a chapter in which you talk about the lost promise of 1989, referring, of course, to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Why didn't that bury communism and this totalitarian impulse once and for all? And why does Europe's establishment, in a related question, why does Europe's establishment hate Christian conservatives and traditional patriots much more than it rejects or opposes former communists?
Well, two great related questions. Well, I mean, in this country, we seem to think things happen by osmosis. We're going to have patriots without creating patriots. You know, yes, there's a certain natural human propensity to love your country, but you have to form patriots. You don't do that by instantiating a culture of repudiation and negation at every level of education and culture. Likewise, we had to draw lessons from the totalitarian episode, which really goes back to the Jacobins during the French Revolution. But the short 20th century, as many writers and scholars have called it, 1914 to 1989 or 91, or for the Bolshevik Revolution to the fall of the Soviet Union, we made no effort to really understand what communism was. We made no effort to understand why it necessarily culminated in criminality, negation of the human spirit, and unprecedented ideological totalitarianism. At best, we said it didn't work, or markets are more efficient than central planning. George Bush Sr. famously said, wouldn't be prudent to talk too much about the fall of the Berlin Wall. And some of our leading thinkers drew paramarxist conclusions from the end of the Cold War. Francis Fukuyama, no Marxist, basically said the victory of communism, the victory of democratic capitalism was historically inevitable. And we have now arrived at an end of history where there will be no future fundamental ideological challenges to the hegemony of liberal democracy and democratic capitalism. It was pure foolishness. It was extrapolating from a moment in time and not seeing that the human and political question would endure. There is no end of history. And liberal democracy is plagued by many internal problems.
Yes.
We've all noticed that it's radicalized considerably. Who would have thought that transgenderism was a necessary component of fidelity to the democratic proposition? It's absurd. So why you ask, do European elites and progressive elites in this country disdain Christian conservatives? Why does saving democracy, to use that Orwellian locution, demand quasi-repression and certainly nonstop rhetorical attack on those who emphasize what our forebears used to emphasize, the moral and religious foundations of a democratic republic or simply a free society? And it's because what they mean by democracy is not all that different in principle, maybe not in practice immediately, from what the communists meant. I don't mean to say they're communists or even pro-communists, but I mean they share a kind of hostility to religion as outmoded, as outdated, as reactionary. They share, as Ryszard Legutko, the Polish philosopher, wrote in The Demon and Democracy, they share the view that the fundamental way to understand politics and society is there are two camps, those on the side of progress, which is secular, progressive, social democratic or socialist, worry of the very idea that there's a normative human nature and enduring standards of right and wrong. And so, as Legutko says, European progressives in the United States, share some of those ends or goals that the communists had. And they see Christian Democrats, I'm using that in the generic sense, people who believe that the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty go hand in hand, as Alexis de Tocqueville famously put it in Democracy in America in 1835, they see them as anti-democratic. And notice, democracy, progressive democracy so defined, has very little to do with the will of the people.
Yes.
If the people are foolish enough to think that democracy, rightly understood, has some traditional and conservative foundations, then it must be made clear that they are not true Democrats, that progress demands overcoming the weight, the oppressive weight of the past. So it's very hard to us to realize that. I'm not saying that the advocates of what the Hungarian philosopher Orel Kolnai calls progressive democracy, I'm not saying they want gulags or they want to repress democracy, but they have a mindset that leads them to see half of the population in their countries as opponents of progressive democracy as they understand it.
Yeah.
So that's another way of highlighting what I've just called the totalitarian impulse that haunts this, you know, I call it self-radicalizing democracy. It's not what George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or probably even Franklin Delano Roosevelt meant by democracy. It's something much more radical than that.
Dan, all things considered, is there reason for optimism that the West's, this trajectory of decline that I brought up earlier, can that be reversed?
You know, it's probably never really a good thing to be an optimist. because, you know, the evidence for optimism is simply not there.
Yes.
On the other hand, we need to hold on to hope, which
yes.
is different than optimism. Optimism is often linked to naivete or linked to that progressivist philosophy of history that I was criticizing. Hope means we can have a certain confidence in the resources of human nature, the fact that eventually, slowly, belatedly, many people wake up. You know, the reaction, I think, against the transgender madness has set in, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought that J.K. Rowling would be leading the fight in the
yes.
United Kingdom? But good for her.
Yeah.
She's quite courageous. And she's not going to be bullied by the mini totalitarians in Scotland and elsewhere, the former actors in her films, the films of her books. I do think when people live with the consequences of the ideological lie, reality has a way of kicking back in. The Latin poet Horace famously said, you can throw nature, human nature, out the front door, but it will always return through the back window. But, you know, sometimes it returns in really distorted ways. The beginning of the conversation, I was talking about young men who are being radicalized by demagogic podcasters, and
mm-hmm.
their reaction to wokeness is, you know, being too open to people like, you know, Alan Tate and Fuentes. And just because the woke called you Nazis falsely and grievously, doesn't mean you should have a soft spot for Nazis, you know?
Right.
So we have to be very careful here. And let me add one more qualification, again, with the caveat that despair is a mortal sin and it gets in the way of the fruitful action, the thoughtful action that's necessary to overcome nihilism and tyranny.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, people like you and I use the word West still because we have a richer sense of the continuity of civilization, as Churchill called it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Churchill gave his great Finest Hour speech on June 18th, 1940, he didn't talk about democracy being at stake. It was Christian civilization that
yes, Christendom, right.
You know, today very few people understand the West in that way,
mm-hmm.
that even liberal democracy depends on a continuity of a richer and broader civilization. Our forebears, who are people of faith, you know, the classical tradition of political prudence, we all act as if democracy began an hour and a half ago. And so I would say educationally, we need to recover a richer notion of democracy, one rooted in the broader resources of Western civilization. But there are some promising developments. There are Christian classical schools. There are
mm-hmm.
the Bardi classical schools sponsored by Hillsdale College. There's alternative universities like UATX. There's these new centers for the study of civic leadership and statesmanship in Western civilization that are opening up in a series of red and purple states and
mm-hmm.
are self-consciously. They're not necessarily conservative per se, although they hire some conservatives, but they're self-consciously opposed to the culture of repudiation and negation.
Yes.
So those are all signs of hope. But there's complacency. I mean, it was really silly after the 2024 presidential election how many articles I read. I wrote one criticizing this view that wokeness was over. Hardly.
Right.
But is it a bit on the defensive? Yes. But could that all change when another administration, unrepentant, committed to a certain level of ideological mendacity, comes to power? Of course. And the universities are biding their times. Many of them, you know, is the DEI thinking gone? No. But it's a lot harder to institutionalize when you've got an administration and courts that have declared it to be, you know, incompatible with American principles. So I'm not a pessimist, and I will never be a pessimist, but I'm not a optimist, because both pessimism and optimism undermine free will informed by right reason, to quote Cicero and St. Thomas Aquinas.
Excellent point. What can the average, the quote-unquote average citizen do to push back against the persistence of this ideological lie and prevent a slide into tyranny here in America?
I will quote Solzhenitsyn, live not by lies. You don't have to go to the top of a hill in the center of town and scream the truth, but do not repeat falsehoods.
Mm-hmm.
Do not send your kids to schools where they will be indoctrinated. How many conservative Christian and Jewish parents do we know who have children who have been radicalized?
Mm-hmm.
It's not good enough just to take your kids to church on Sunday and leave it on that. Education, paideia, has to begin in the home. There has to be a self-conscious effort to give your children, your kids, a fighting chance to reject ideological lies, not to be unwittingly indoctrinated. Obviously, parents have limited control, but they ought to have some control, some influence, some be able to shape the souls of their children. One of the biggest problems we've faced in the what's left of the Western world in the last generation or two, it's become increasingly difficult for decent people, people of faith and patriotism and right reason, to replicate their commitments with their children. That's got to change. And I think, you know, one has a choice, but don't repeat things you don't believe. Don't go along with the crowd. And everyone of every generation, listen to good podcasts like this. I listen to a lot of good podcasts. But do not become a slave to the gadgets. Read the classics. Read good magazines like in the old days.
Yep.
Read good websites. But do not become a slave of TikTok or Facebook.
Yes.
Or any of these things that drive out deeper civic and civilizational reflection.
Well, I'm totally on board with every one of those suggestions. Dan, what are you working on now? And also, how can people keep up with your work online?
I write for every issue of the Claremont Review books. I have a big piece in the new double 25th anniversary issue out in December 17th on James Burnham, the conservative philosopher and strategist, former editor of National Review in the old days. I write a lot for the New Criterion. I write at least once a month for the American Mind. I occasionally review and write for Civitas Outlook and Law and Liberty. I have Christmas book recommendations out today at the Claremont Review of Books online.
Oh, good.
I'm doing my Christmas book recommendations by Wednesday afternoon for Catholic World Report. So I'm all over the place. I'm finishing two books. One is on Solzhenitsyn's two masterworks, The Gulag Archipelago, the greatest spiritually significant anti-totalitarian classic of the 20th century,
yep.
A book not only about the evils of totalitarianism, but about what we need to do to preserve and elevate the human soul. His book on the Red Wheel, How Russia Turned to Totalitarianism in the First Place. But I have another book that is a portrait of 15 thinkers who can provide guidance, mainly from the 20th and 21st century, who can provide, you might say, inspiration, thought, material for resistance to the distortions in our culture, to spiritual ideological mendacity. Some people will be very familiar with, some they'll be less familiar with. But it's a kind of guidebook to the deep thought that can sustain decent politics and the life of the spirit. My Solzhenitsyn book is, it's a phrase from the Gulag, the sparks of the spirit.
Oh.
We need to keep the sparks of the spirit alive.
Yeah, very interesting. I would look forward to both of those.
Yeah, I'm a busy man. I'm a book writer. I've done 14, including my edited volumes. And one thing I think writing helps me think.
Mm-hmm.
Writing books is a way of engaging these kind of questions at a deeper level. So I'll do it as long as there's some energy and breath left in me.
Excellent. Daniel Mahoney, thanks so much for coming to The Right Take, and keep up the great work.
Thank you, Mark. Really fun to do this.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. We'll be seeing you.